Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 561, titled Economics 911 Part 2. This is being recorded on July 16th of 2006. We're going to plunge right back in and talk about the macroeconomic and macro-political implications of the increase in oil prices. Again, aside from the superficial aspects of this, one should note that the net effect of the instability in the Middle East is to not only drive up the price of oil, but also to effect a massive transfer of wealth. I would note, too, that in addition to, obviously, the transfer of wealth that is going from everything and everybody into the coffers of the oil companies and related interests, elements within the corridors of power who are in a position to do so could cash in mightily on the commodities futures by floating information, whether it's a story, say, and this is simply hypothetical, say you want to float a story to Seymour Hersh for The New Yorker about contingency plans to bomb Iran or something similar. Basically, if you can anticipate some of this or float a story that would cause alarm in the petroleum markets, you can go short in the market and make an enormous amount of money. We're going to talk about the fear factor in the rise of oil prices. I disagree in part with some of the things that are said in the article that's about to follow. Yeah, certainly as places like India and China industrialize, there's increasing demand for oil, but there are also growing numbers of oil strikes. When the world's attention was focused on the tsunami, for example, in early 2005, in fact, the Chinese announced an enormous discovery of oil, and they felt that by the time this new field was developed, it would go a long way towards satisfying China's energy needs. That had almost no effect. It wasn't even noticed by most people. But the oil bulls, as they're going to be termed in this article, maintain that the reason why oil price is going up is because of increased demand. Well, the increase in demand isn't going up that damn fast since 2003, but the instability due to all of the violence has sure as hell been soaring, and that, in my considered opinion, is the primary factor here. But let's get into the article itself, and then we'll talk more about it. This is from the Financial Times of Wednesday, July 5th of 2006, article by Kevin Morrison and Stephen Schur. It's called Fear Factor and Soaring Demand Blamed for Crude Price Leap. And it reads in part, since the price of oil began its rocky but seemingly inexorable climb above $40 a barrel in 2003, parenthetically the year in which the U.S. invaded Iraq, continuing, there has been widespread debate about what is driving it. Crude bears have contended higher energy prices are heavily influenced by a risk premium, unquote, amid fears of terrorist or political disruptions to supply. Bulls, conversely, acknowledge a premium but say it's far less important than the soaring demand from developed and developing countries amid ever-tightening supply. So far, the bears have been punished mightily, while the bulls have been among the best compensated investors in the world. Clearly, there is some risk premium, says James Melcher, manager of Balestra Capital, a New York-based hedge fund that has notched up strong returns in recent years, in part thanks to energy-related bets. Quote, if the Israeli-Palestinian mess simmers down, Venezuela settles down, and the Iranian situation progresses in a benign way, I think oil will come down to maybe $55 or $60, but it isn't going back to the $40 range. Unquote. There has been no shortage of events to fuel the fear factor. Notwithstanding the failed attack on Saudi Arabia's Abdaiq facility, Nigerian militants closed significant parts of the country's production early this year. There are continued attacks on Iraqi oil infrastructure, and the nuclear standoff continues between Iran and the West, all of which have kept oil traders busy and stoked concerns about future oil supplies, which has helped push oil prices to more than $70 a barrel this week. Well, again, I think in many ways that article speaks for itself. I do not agree with the, quote, bulls, unquote. Yeah, there's increased demand for oil around the world, but it has been, and that has been known for a long time. The fact that India and China were industrializing at a rapid pace has been known for a long time, and yet at the same time, the oil companies, for example, have deliberately restricted refining capacity, driving up the price of gas. They also have not built heavy offshore oil drilling equipment in the quantity that it would be required. And so the result is, and by the way, this is about to take place in the Gulf of Mexico, the result is that oil drilling equipment is being relocated from places like the Gulf of Mexico to areas that will yield a higher return. Well, again, the dominant financial interests in this world certainly know that places like India and China are industrializing at a quick pace, and yet they have deliberately kept down refining capacity. They have not built offshore oil equipment, and that is leading to an increase in not only the price of oil, but the price of gasoline. And that was anticipated, and it is deliberate. Note also that the continued violence in the Middle East is also driving up the price of oil. And again, like many people, initially I was looking at the violence itself as the main story. But increasingly, I'm looking at the economic and consequent political effects of that violence. It is one of the most, I would say it is probably the single most profound economic dynamic in the world today, and it is absolutely going to lead to a hands-on, across-the-board triumph by the most reactionary elements in the world, because everything and everybody, indirectly or indirectly, uses oil. You jack up the price of that, then you have a brutal economic social Darwinism. The, quote, strongest, unquote, i.e. the richest, those best able to absorb the increase will survive. And everything and everybody else, individuals or institutions that can't absorb that increase, are going down. And that, in my opinion, is probably what is intended here. Hence, the look at the big picture of economics and September 11th and related matters. More about the price of oil increase. The Financial Times of April 22nd and April 23rd of 2006 carries this article by Garrett Smythe in Tehran and Guy Dinmore in Washington. Subtitled Iran and the West, it's titled Rising Crude Oil Prices Very Good, says Ahmadi Nejad. Parenthetically, I would note that not only is the president of Iran a Holocaust denier, but the Iranian fundamentalists came to power in the late 1970s after Ayatollah Khomeini basically had his exile in France paid for by the late François Jeannot, one of the most important Nazi spies and financiers. He not only was the banker to the Grand Mufti and somebody who financed the trials of Adolf Eichmann and Klaus Barbie, he, that is to say, François Jeannot, had much to do with the post-war disbursement of Nazi funds, thereby inevitably working with the Bormann Capital Network. He also had much to do with the post-war diaspora of Nazi war criminals. Most importantly, the late François Jeannot was the heir to the political last will and testament and collected literary works of Adolf Hitler, Martin Bormann, and Joseph Goebbels. And it was he who sponsored the Ayatollah Khomeini in exile in France, and one of Jeannot's protégés, Ahmed Huber, a director of the bank Alpaco, is very, very close to the Iranian mullahs and the Holocaust-denying president of Iran. And that Holocaust-denying president is talking about rising crude oil prices very good. Reads in part this article, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, Iran's fundamentalist president, said yesterday rising crude oil prices were very good, unquote, reflecting his belief that events are moving in Iran's favor as Russia appeared to rule out sanctions against Tehran without proof its nuclear program was designed to produce weapons. Oil prices yesterday rose above $75 a barrel on concern that shipments from Iran and Nigeria will be disrupted. The president's remarks will be read in some quarters as a warning to those who advocate action either economic or military against Tehran over its nuclear ambitions that Iran's position as the fourth largest global oil producer makes it a difficult target. On Thursday, Mr. Ahmadinejad announced Tehran was studying a dual pricing scheme to cushion poor countries against higher oil prices, while countries with hundreds of billions of dollars should pay the real price of oil, unquote. Since becoming president last year, Mr. Ahmadinejad has faced Western condemnation for fiery verbal attacks on Israel, but his support for the Palestinians and egalitarian slogans have courted popularity among many in the Arab and Islamic worlds. His proposal that, quote, poor consumers, unquote, should get lower oil prices plays into that same populism. Again, thinking about all of the instability, about the scary nuclear face-off between the Iranians and the U.S. and others, think about the fact, for example, that the Iranian nuclear capability comes from the AQ Khan network, which was sponsored largely by the Saudi-financed Safari Club, as we looked at and among other programs for the record 556. Do the Saudis benefit from high oil prices? Indeed. Does a crude bear expletive deleted in the woods, so to speak? Well, of course they do. The Saudis, by the way, also are the financial backers of both Hamas and first the PLO and later the Palestinian Authority. And the Iranians are the main backers of Hezbollah, along with a minor, relatively minor role by Syria. And as one looks at the violence now unfolding on the two borders of Israel, where you've got warfare vis-a-vis Israel and Hamas on one side of Israel, and warfare vis-a-vis Hezbollah and Israel on the other, bear in mind that both of those proxy guerrilla groups, those proxy warriors, are being financed by two major oil producers who stand a great deal to gain from the instability because it drives up the price of oil and increases their profits. Remember that. Another fascinating thing that is taking place vis-a-vis the enormous increase in oil prices, and in turn, as countries are paying tremendous amounts of wealth to the oil-producing countries, that oil wealth is being recycled into investment in countries like the United States. One of the things that's very interesting to me, a lot of the reactionary elements in this country are taking up the old Nazi saw about Jewish control of the news media. It's probably because the New York Times has a lot of Jewish editors. But in fact, that is not the case. Not only are Jews not controlling the media in this country, but to a large extent, the Saudis are controlling the news media in this country. Let's take a look at some of the largest media corporations in the world. The largest media corporation in the world is AOL Time Warner, which has a controlling minority interest wielded by a consortium of Saudi princes, chiefly Prince Al-Waleed, one of the richest men in the world, who owns something like a little more over 1% of AOL Time Warner stock by himself. By the way, that doesn't sound like a lot to the uninitiated, but with one of these giant corporations owning when 2% or more of their stock changes hands in a single day, that's viewed as something of a run on its stock and can have a disproportionately large effect on depressing the price of the stock. So when you own even 1 or 2% of one of these giant corporations, it's a lot. The largest media corporation of the world is AOL Time Warner, controlled by a consortium of Saudi princes. Second largest media corporation of the world is News Corp, owned by Rupert Murdoch, but the second largest investor in News Corp and its Fox News subsidiary, which, by the way, reinforces the policies of the Bush administration, which in turn reinforces the instability, which in turn drives up the price of oil, which in turn puts money into the coffers of the Saudis. The second largest investor in News Corp behind Rupert Murdoch is Prince Al-Waleed. Prince Al-Waleed is heavily invested in Disney. Specifically, he bailed out at Disney's Euroworld. And ABC Disney is the third largest media corporation in the world. Other Middle Eastern oil-producing countries also have wield tremendous capital influence within major corporations. The tiny little, at least in terms of numbers, Kuwaiti Investment Authority owns 7% of Daimler Chrysler. The Kuwaiti Investment Authority is the largest investor in Aventis, the largest pharmaceutical company in the world. The Iranian government has something like a 5 to 7% interest in the Thyssen Krupp, the largest heavy industrial group in Europe. So again, as one contemplates the increase in oil prices, bear in mind that as the capital is channeled into those oil-producing countries, they are recycling it and buying influence in other countries, both with corporations and with nonprofit organizations. There was something of a brouhaha earlier this year when a couple of professors named Mearsha, anyway, I've forgotten the names, a couple of professors at Harvard published an article initially in a British publication talking about the Israel lobby and its deleterious effect on American policy, and this produced sort of the predictable response where some people said, yeah, it's about time. People talked about that, and then other people said, well, that's anti-Semitic, etc. But what people did not pay attention to was that a couple of months before these two professors published their paper on the Israel lobby and saying it's time to, for the U.S. to cut it loose, Prince Al-Walid made a $20 million donation to Harvard University to promote, quote, Muslim-Christian understanding, unquote. And that, in turn, followed the appointment of an Oxford-educated Middle Eastern gentleman. I believe he was Saudi, of Saudi extraction. He might have been from India, but I believe he was an Arab of Oxford and British educational extraction. He was basically put in charge of investments for Harvard University, which has a lot of money. Then Prince Al-Walid donates $20 million to Harvard, and then two professors say, gosh, it's time we did something about the Israel lobby. Public opinion, to a large extent, is a commodity, and it can be bought. Prince Al-Walid also made a $20 million donation, or a big donation, to Georgetown University. And the Saudis are funding Middle Eastern studies programs at major American universities, even as their own population continues to be roughly 50% illiterate. So pay attention to not just the increase in oil prices, but also the resulting effect as that oil wealth that's flowing into these Middle Eastern oil kingdoms is reinvested in the corporate landscapes of Western countries, and also in the educational landscape of these countries. It is ultimately, as Ahmed Huber, neo-Nazi and director of Bank al-Taqwa, said, we will change public opinion, meaning about Israel, in the United States. When it happens, you'll know. And you watch the Saudi investment in major news corporations and major media corporations and in funding Middle Eastern studies programs at universities, promoting, quote, Christian Muslim, not Christian Muslim Jewish, but Christian Muslim understanding at places like Harvard and Georgetown. And you can see what he's talking about. By the way, whenever one criticizes the Saudis, there are always some elements in the so-called progressive sector that accuse one of anti-Arab racism. Let me reiterate that in the late 1990s, the Saudis hired an American neo-Nazi named William Grimstead as a Washington lobbyist. So if there's some of you out there who want to cry racism, check that out, okay? Fascinating observation, and this, what I'm about to talk about, hovers at the very edge of my own understanding of corporate and financial matters. But there is someone who chooses to remain anonymous. This is a former investigator for the Securities and Exchange Commission, a brilliant individual, and someone who also works in the counterterrorist advisory field. And this is a truly brilliant individual, and someone who I perhaps maybe sounds like bragging, but has a high regard for my own work. And this person who chooses to remain anonymous emailed me some things, and here's what he had to say. The Wall Street Journal of Friday, May 26th of 2006, had an article, Saudis Seek Bank of China Stake. And it reads in part, new shares issued by the Bank of China raise $9.7 billion, constituting 10.5% of its enlarged capital share. $2 billion U.S. dollars were invested by Prince Al-Walid's Al-Azia, leading the group, with Ma'an bin Abdul Wahid Al-Sani, Mahadib Group, Olayan Group, Olayan Saudi Investment Company, Bahamden Holding Company, and Amwal Al-Khalej Commercial Investment Company. $2.26 billion Bank of Tokyo, Mitsubishi Bank of China Group, and Bank of East Asia Limited, and $5.1 billion of Singapore's Temasek Holdings, UBS Octane Gesellschaft, by the way, a key Borman bank, and the Royal Bank of Scotland, 89.5% government of China. Now, again, that's the Saudis seeking a Bank of China stake. This individual is former brilliant Securities and Exchange Commission investigator, interpreted this for me as follows. He writes, If the Bank of China has the traditional balance sheet of 10% capital, stockholders' equity and retained earnings, with the classical balance of 20% outside debt and 10% accruals and 60% deposits, Chinese government, and the stockholders' equity is $90 billion U.S., that means they can lend at least $90 billion per customer, which means they can own any number of governments around the world, their entire central banks. I see the role of Al-Waleed, UBS, Royal Bank of Scotland, and Bank of Tokyo, Mitsubishi, to be one of sweet talk, unquote, to encourage governments to borrow from the Bank of China, where the bank could then exercise tremendous influence over those governments. In the international community, they are likely as not as interested in consumer lending outside of China, and I don't know what they charge in interest for domestic loans, as I've not studied the bank in detail yet, but I see the geopolitical purpose as one of serving empire, of which the Saudis are a part. Now, again, this is complicated. This hovers at the very borderline of my own understanding of these things, because I am not a securities and exchange investigator. But tip of the hat to this gentleman who researched this for us and believes that basically, once again, that enormous capital flowing into the coffers of the Saudis is going to lead once again to control by that extremely reactionary element of a great deal of what is left of our world. Now, another thing that I've noted in connection with the increase in oil prices is the fact that as oil has become more expensive, it has led to something that I had predicted, which was the resuscitation of the old Fischer-Tropsch hydrogenation process that was developed by IG Farben in the 1920s, and that was the focal point of the Standard IG Agreement of 1929. I've talked about that at great length and among other programs, For the Record 506, For the Record 552, and in one of the sort of Dave Emery Goes Out on a Limb broadcast, For the Record 385, called Formula for Disaster, I analyzed the book The Formula. The Formula is a novel by Steve Shagan that was made into a major motion picture starring Marlon Brando and George C. Scott. What the novel is about a formula for a catalyst developed by IG Farben during World War II. In the novel, it's called the Mangan Catalyst, that then becomes the focal point for intrigue in the post-war world as powerful interests vie either to access that formula or to keep it secret. What ultimately turns out is that the oil companies themselves were trying to keep, the oil cartel was trying to keep that formula secret so that it would not represent a threat to their naturally produced petroleum. In For the Record 385, and I'm encapsulating it here, I voiced my opinion that in fact this novel, as is sometimes the case, was fact presented as fiction because the facts were too controversial. Some people may have seen the movie 3 Days of the Condor, starring Robert Redford and Faye Dunaway. In that movie, Robert Redford plays a CIA analyst codenamed the Condor, who reads fiction and then analyzes it and sends that to Langley in order to basically ferret out from fiction things that are actually taking place. That is actually something that that does occur within the intelligence community, and I believe that The Formula by Steve Shagan is just such a book. It's fact, more or less presented as fiction, because the facts are too controversial to be published in a journalistic nonfiction context. And one of the things that I noted in the book The Formula and in the description for, well, both the actual broadcast and For the Record 385, I noted the confrontation between Adam Stiefel, played by Marlon Brando, the head of a major oil company, and Barney, who was a retired LAPD detective played by George C. Scott, who was used by the oil companies to basically hunt down some people who were threatening to release the Mangan catalyst, thereby upsetting the cartel. And in that confrontation, George C. Scott says, "We will manufacture synthetic fuel, and in great quantity. We already own most of the coal in the country. We know what's coming. We have the formula. We have the Mangan catalyst, and we have the technology. But we must be certain of profit." By the way, the book was published in 1978. By 1990, the country will be on its knees to OPEC. The government will then turn to us, and in their desperation, they will ensure our profit position in the manufacture of synthetic fuel. Well, as I noted in For the Record 552, that is exactly what is taking place. And note that among the effects of the increase in the price of oil is to make the hydrogenation process, the Fischer-Tropsch process, the focal point of the Standard IG agreement, viable once again to the great profit of those who control the process. Yet another article in that context, the Financial Times of Wednesday, July 12th of 2006, has the following article by Richard McGregor. It's titled, Shell Ali's $5 billion coal-to-oil fuel plant in China. Royal Dutch Shell and a Chinese partner committed yesterday to a 3-year study of a coal-to-liquid fuel plant in western Ningxia province, which, if it went ahead, would be one of China's largest foreign investments. Lim Ha Kuang, executive chairman of Shell in China, said a plant of the size envisioned would cost between $5 and $6 billion to build, although Shell said this was a preliminary estimate and should not be taken as a guide to the final cost. The Shell joint venture is part of an investment surge into coal-to-liquid plants in China, driven by a combination of the country's abundant coal, rising energy demand, and, surprise, surprise, record, that's my interjection, by the way, record oil prices. Just under 30 such projects are in the detailed planning or feasibility stage, according to a report by Credit Suisse, with a projected output equivalent to 10% of the country's present oil demand. The costly capital-intensive CTL plants are generally considered to be financially viable when oil prices are above $35 to $40 a barrel, which the industry thinks is a good bet. Of course, that happened in 2003 when they went up permanently, basically, over that. That was the year that we invaded Iraq. You don't suppose there might have been a connection there, do you? Nah. Coal is China's, quote, real strategic energy reserve, says the Credit Suisse report, because it could all be sourced locally rather than imported. China has another 30 coal-to-methanol plants being built or going through the approval process. That also, by the way, is the same variant of the Fischer-Tropsch process. And skipping down, in the last paragraph of the article, the technology to turn coal into gas and oil was invented in the 1920s in Germany, where it was used to make fuel for the armed forces in the Second World War. That is exactly what I was predicting in For the Record 385. And I want to note, reviewing very briefly something from For the Record 552, guess what took place? Well, what came to light recently? They have some researchers in the U.S. have developed, surprise, surprise, a catalyst which makes the Fischer-Tropsch coal-to-liquid process much, much more efficient and thereby, quote, viable, unquote. Can you imagine such a thing? This following article, and I'm going to excerpt it briefly, is from Technology Review, Clean Diesel from Coal by Kevin Bullis from Technology Review of April 19th of 2006. It reads in part, as the cost of oil soars and worries over the U.S. dependence on foreign petroleum escalate, coal is becoming an increasingly attractive alternative as a feedstock to make a range of fuels. Now, chemists have invented a new catalytic process that could increase the yield of a clean form of diesel made from coal. The method, described in the current issue of the journal Science, uses a pair of catalysts to improve the yield of diesel fuel from Fischer-Tropsch synthesis, a nearly century-old chemical technique for reacting carbon monoxide and hydrogen to make hydrocarbons. The mixture of gases is produced by heating coal. Although Germany used the process during World War II to convert coal to fuel for its military vehicles, FT synthesis had generally been too expensive to compete with oil. But now that oil has increased so much in terms of price, and with this catalyst, surprise, surprise, now it's viable. Told you so. That concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 561, Economics 911 Part 2, being recorded on July 16th of 2006. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.